This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Today's economics lesson, every action has its equal and opposite reaction. Simple example, when you pay higher prices, some companies make a lot more money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, November 15th, and it's good to have you with us. So, yeah, we know the list. Inflation is the highest it's been in 30 years. Supply chains are broken. Labor is in short supply. But rising costs don't seem to be hurting everyone's bottom line. The Wall Street Journal reports that profits at 2/3 of the biggest public companies in the U.S. are higher than in 2019. Some companies are raising prices higher than their costs might dictate. Others are trying to figure out how to tell their customers about price hikes without making them feel ripped off. Marketplace's Matt Levin reports on the delicate balance.
You know those public apologies you see at some restaurants now? The, hey, we're sorry, we had to raise prices sign affixed to the cash register or top of the menu? Diego Ramos is not a fan.
It's not something you ever want to advertise.
Ramos is general manager at Shiloh's Deli in downtown San Antonio. Since pork and egg prices have been soaring, the popular two-egg breakfast plate now costs 50 cents more. The tourists who eat at Shiloh's haven't noticed, but the regulars?
Everyone says the same thing. They're like, man, you guys have gotten pricing. You know, we don't like charging more money. It doesn't always mean that we're going to make more income.
Right now, consumers may be more willing to accept price increases as a fact of life, says Mohan Sawhney, a professor at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. But a company can't just wave the I word around recklessly.
You can't just say, for instance, that because of inflation, your prices have gone up. You have to be clear about whether your input costs have gone up, whether there are shortages of components that have been affecting you.
Many companies don't like being that direct, so they camouflage price hikes, reducing the number of goodies per package or using weird euphemisms.
I've seen things like we are rationalizing our prices, we are adjusting.
You know, price adjusting, when a company brings in a chiropractor to put the price in better alignment. For everyday items, consumers may not even know how severe that adjustment is, says Utpal Dholakia, marketing professor at Rice University.
I think there's this myth that prices are well known in the marketplace and everyone knows what the price is and how much it has changed.
You may not notice bread or peanut butter or milk is a few cents more expensive. You'll just see your grocery bill is higher and shrug, hey, inflation. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, is the entire stock market ultimately at the mercy of Tesla CEO Elon Musk, who can tank his own stock 20% with a massive sell-off and take the other major indices with it? Of course not. That's ridiculous. But maybe, though, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Biden signed the bipartisan infrastructure bill today, which includes the largest federal investment in combating climate change in U.S. history. Good news, since the deal coming out of the big U.N. summit, COP26, does not put the world on track to get to global net zero carbon emissions by 2050. But we already know how to get to net zero, and the key technology to do it has been around for more than a century. Electrify everything. Swap out all the technologies that run on fossil fuels, like cars and water heaters and gas stoves, with electric alternatives, like EVs and heat pumps and induction ovens. Going all electric would eradicate nearly 75% of global emissions, especially if the energy itself comes from solar or wind. In my new podcast, How We Survive, I've been digging into what it would take to make this transition. And I've met some people trying very hard to make an all-electric, battery-powered world our future reality. Like Devin DeWolf, a teacher, artist, and community organizer who's lived in New Orleans for over a decade.
Oh my God!
This summer, on the 16-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, another Category 4 storm, Hurricane Ida, made landfall in Louisiana. Devin and his family were among those who stayed behind.
The storm itself is one thing, and then the aftermath of the storm is a whole other thing.
Devin's neighborhood was left without power for 10 days.
Every day it was easily 110 degrees.
But Devin did not lose power. His house was the only one in the neighborhood where the lights stayed on, and it was not a stroke of good luck.
Our house had the solar panels and two batteries.
Solar panels and two home batteries, which cost Devin roughly $60,000 in total, powered his two-story home when the grid went down. The solar panels on his roof charge the batteries, which store the energy to keep things like his refrigerator and window fans running. And when the batteries get low on juice, the solar panels charge them back up during the day.
My house went through 10 days with no power, easy peasy, because after the hurricane, the sun will rise again.
Devin's house became the community charging station. Neighbors charged their phones at his house during the day, and the charging station may even have helped save lives.
Mr. Roy needed an oxygen machine, so I ran an extension cord from my house to his house to take care of that. I've got another elderly neighbor, and I, you know, hooked up his refrigerator during the daylight when I had solar.
In the days after the storm, Devin decided to start a campaign to get solar panels and batteries installed in businesses across New Orleans.
We need to empower community by community, those people to really become the first responders and not really need outside assistance.
His plan is all about creating resiliency through decentralization, spreading out the infrastructure so that if one system fails, there are others to pick up the slack.
I think the question for the utility companies and their regulators and entrepreneurs like myself is like, who's gonna drive and own that innovation and decentralization?
This is Donnell Baird, the founder of Block Power, a startup that's definitely driving that decentralization. Block Power finances and installs energy efficient tech in homes and city buildings across the country. His mission is a supercharged version of Devin's plan. One building at a time, Donnell hopes to electrify entire cities and replace all fuel-dependent tech with clean electric alternatives. What building blocks, no pun intended, need to be in place for that to happen? Like back up all the way to, you know, the smart grid, for example.
Oh, God, that's a big question, Molly. Okay, so
I know.
We're going to need a lot of new roofs to support rooftop solar. We're going to need batteries in folks' garages and backyards. We're going to need this innovation that we think is really important, which is the all-electric cold climate heat pump that's like a smart all-electric air conditioner that can also run in reverse.
That's what it takes to electrify a home. Multiply that by 129 million, and you've electrified every building in America.
And we must do that in order to navigate the worst impacts of climate change. The sooner the better.
But right now, we're not moving fast enough, says Donnell.
And our view is like, we need to electrify 3, 4, 5 American cities in the next 4 to 6 years and generate a data set that can be shared with all cities around the world on hey, this is the blueprint for you to electrify all of your buildings and all of your vehicles in your city. Is it hard? Yeah, it's hard, but it's possible.
A net zero or carbon-free future is possible, but only if that future is electric. During the COP26 summit that ended this weekend, the U.S. and China announced a surprise agreement to work together on cutting emissions. President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping are scheduled to meet at a virtual summit this evening, where they'll likely talk about that deal, geopolitics, diplomatic tensions. And underlying all of it is, of course, the economic relationship between the two countries, where China right now has a bit of the upper hand. Its economy performed really well through the pandemic compared to our fits and starts. And while things are cooling off some parts, especially trade, are still booming. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more.
China's economy was the only major world economy to escape recession during the pandemic. Growth fell to a mere 2.3%, according to the IMF, and it bounced back with a fury from there.
And in the first half of 2021, it was growing like gangbusters, 12.7% real growth from the year before.
David Dollar is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
The data coming in suggests that after the first half of the year, the Chinese economy is really skidded to a halt.
Between the second and third quarters, real GDP growth in China was only 0.2%, says Nargiza Salijanova, director of China projects at Rhodium Group.
China's property sector has been struggling. You know, China had an energy crisis. They're still struggling with the COVID-19 related overhang.
China still has a zero tolerance COVID policy and isn't shy to return to lockdowns when there are cases. The government has also cracked down on some sectors like property and tech, which it believes have escaped regulation for too long. Still, China's economy is predicted by the IMF to grow 5.6% next year. Low for China, but not too bad.
Yeah, they're not growing at 10%, but they're still growing faster than everyone else.
Nicholas Lardy is senior fellow at the Peterson Institute. He says China is attracting foreign direct investment rapidly. And as world trade shrank in 2020, China's trade activity grew and is still growing.
They're increasing their share of global trade quite dramatically. China's managing to increase both its imports and its exports this year by over 30%.
And Lardy points out it's doing so without the extended port clogs the U.S. is experiencing and managing to keep inflation low as well. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up?
Super early in the morning, and I went to bed at 1 a.m.
Ooh, yeah, that's a no for me. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial lost 12 points, staying flat to finish at 36,087. The NASDAQ dipped 7 points, also flat, to end at 15,853. And the S&P 500 lost less than a tenth of a point. That is also flat, to land at 4682. We heard earlier that keeping everything in our homes running may soon depend on the sun. In solar stocks, Enphase Energy dipped 2.7%. Sunrun Inc. lost 1.1%. Solar Edge Technologies rose 1.6%. If you're looking ahead to a road trip this Thanksgiving, consider an EV. Gasoline is up nearly 50% since this time last year. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.61%. You're listening to Marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. In addition to that meeting with China's president that Sabri mentioned earlier, President Biden had some long overdue electronic FaceTime with tribal leaders today. The White House Tribal Nations Summit convened for the first time since the Obama years. One big economic issue on the agenda for the two-day event is tribal health care and how decades of underinvestment in the federal Indian Health Service made tribal communities especially vulnerable during the pandemic. Marketplace's Savannah Marr reports.
During his opening remarks at the Tribal Nations Summit, President Biden acknowledged the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on tribal communities.
Native Americans contracted the virus at over three times the rate of white Americans, nearly twice the rate of lives lost.
That's due in part to high rates of pre-existing illnesses among Native people. In a roundtable, Chairman Amber Torres of the Walker River Paiute Tribe said many of those illnesses were preventable.
As a tribal leader, our requests continue to be the same for the past 20 years, such as full funding for IHS.
That's the Indian Health Service, the federal agency that delivers health care to Native Americans. The House Appropriations Committee has proposed boosting the Indian Health Service's 2022 budget from $6.2 to $8.1 billion. That's still a fraction of the $48 billion that tribal leaders say it would actually take to meet their community's health care needs.
I truly feel that if these requests had been honored, Indian country would have been better prepared for COVID-19 pandemic.
Cheryl Andrews-Maltese chairs the Aquinnah-Wampanoag Tribal Council. She wants to see more accurate collection of health data related to Native people. She says it's been hard to know how many urban tribal members have been vaccinated, since non-tribal healthcare providers haven't been tracking it.
They weren't asking whether people were members of a federally recognized tribe.
Another problem that she says needs federal attention, boosting the number of Indian healthcare centers in cities.
For tribal members that live outside of our reservation areas.
That describes most Indigenous people in this country, according to the IHS. But less than 1% of the agency's budget goes to urban Indian healthcare. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
The future of the workplace in a less pandemic-y world is still coming into focus, but one big takeaway, flexibility is key. A recent Gallup poll suggests that most people still prefer some office time. After all, sharing a workplace with kids, dogs, and laundry for the last 19 months has had its challenges. And lots of people crave the social ties and collaboration of a communal setting, but workers aren't rushing to cram back into downtown high-rise office buildings. The real future is likely to be something in between. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
Rodney Mora runs a small product development agency in LA, so he needs a space to bring his scattered team together at least a couple days a week to review the products they work on.
As we went into this whole weird transition from everyone working in the office to everyone working at home, and now kind of somewhat in between, employees and workers are looking for a place that, if they do have to go in, makes them happy.
So he moved his company from a garden variety office to an actual garden.
It's really funny whenever we're on Zoom and someone sees our background, they're like, are you in a tropical landscape? And it's like, no, we're just in our outdoor office space. It's like kind of working in a little nice, calm jungle, if you will.
It's called Second Home Hollywood, an arboretum-like co-working space that opened just before the pandemic, where fully half the space is outdoors, with desks nestled among mature monstera plants and banana trees.
We're walking right now through a 1.5-acre garden, what has been described as the densest urban forest in Los Angeles, 6,500 trees and plants, 112 different species.
Rohan Silva is the founder of Second Home, which has several branches in Europe and plans to expand in the U.S. They specialize in workspaces that don't look like offices or homes really either. Maybe more like the second home of a fabulously wealthy jet setter who owns a tropical island. One with hospital-grade air filtration. Oh, and a Michelin-starred restaurant on site. Seriously.
If your office is just a kind of a sterile cubicle with dirty recirculated air and so on, probably quite hard to persuade people to come in.
Private offices start at around $3,000 a month. Hot desks like Rodney Mora uses about $400 per person. Not going to fit everyone's taste and budget, sort of like the black sesame vichyssoise they serve at the restaurant. It's a kind of soup, I think. But the point is that the more going to work becomes a choice, the more workplaces become sort of like a consumer product, says Dror Pollig, author of Rethinking Real Estate.
So people will still use space, and I think people will pay for it more than ever before, at least those that need it, but they'll be much more deliberate about it.
He says office spaces historically have been almost purposely bland. Think elevator music. It's just the background, designed to offend or excite no one. But in a work anywhere world, there are infinite alternatives.
What we are starting to see is the emergence of these lifestyle offices or home-like offices, much crazier types of amenities and activities.
Saks Fifth Avenue is opening a number of fashionable office spaces inside their department stores. Restaurants have turned dining tables into desks that can be booked on apps like Kettle Space. And hotels are increasingly adding remote work travel packages.
So where you would have done a stodgy conference room, it was just, you know, more comfortable. So let's sit on couches. Let's talk.
Kyle Arteaga runs a marketing agency that gave up most of its office space during the pandemic. As public health conditions have improved, teams have begun meeting up again, not in offices, but in hotels, in destinations of employees choosing.
We want that separation from home because, you know, we're all spending so much time there. But at the same time, there are some benefits that we've kind of become acclimated to, and we want to carry that over.
He's planning the next all-staff meetup for February at a hotel in Washington, D.C. Whether it'll have a Michelin-starred restaurant on site is still to be determined. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
If you're hosting a Thanksgiving meal, this is probably the week when you're getting very serious about menu planning. If you're running a food business, you are for sure already working on the holiday orders. Rita Magaldi is deep in the orders. She runs Sheer Ambrosia, a baklava bakery in Draper, Utah. We've been following her since early in the pandemic, and last year the holidays were extra busy for her, baking at night and juggling her second job that she got to cover for a slowdown in her business. We called her up to hear how things are looking this year.
Business is great. Yesterday, I started working, gosh, I can't remember, super early in the morning, and I went to bed at 1 a.m. So I am very busy these days, not complaining. I had been holding on to the second job. I thought that, you know, I was so lucky to have gotten that at the beginning of COVID in March of 2020. And I didn't think it was smart to just let it go, even though my business has definitely come back strong. But ironically, the company that saved my business and saved me financially, the virus took a toll on that company, and they're actually closing down our office. The reality is my heart and my passion is with my business. And when the news was broken that, you know, they were going to have to let me go, I wasn't too terribly heartbroken. I always said the universe is conspiring in my favor. I was super nervous about how I was going to manage this second job and my business during the holidays, because literally last year I used vacation time. I'd saved up all of my vacation time and then took time off of that job so that I could focus 100% on the business. And I just wasn't sure if that was going to be enough. I've been working hard building the business. And so I know that this season is going to be even bigger than last season.
November and December, I do more business in those 2 months than, I wouldn't go as far as to say the entire 10 other months combined, but close. So it's going to be a long 2 months. But come January, you know, everybody's going to go on their New Year's resolution diet. And I go from being the most famous, beloved person to the most infamous person. Nobody wants baklava in January. I've kind of put the whole house on the back burner right now, because the more money I can make during these busy times, and if I focus on that, focus on my customer service, focus on providing the best experience, holiday experience, then the more likely I will be able to buy a home. So first things first.
Rita Magaldi there. She runs Sheer Ambrosia in Draper, Utah. This final note on the way out today, here's a shocker for you. Turns out when celebrities sell NFT art, you know, those digital collectibles tied to blockchain technology, it might be a really big moneymaker for them, but maybe not a great investment for the people who buy them. I know. Bloomberg reports today that some non-fungible tokens from the musician Grimes lost 84% of their value when people tried to resell them. And wrestler John Cena only sold 37 of the 500 NFTs he co-created with the WWE. Listen, long-term, who knows? NFTs could be a great investment. But if it seems like the digital equivalent of a branded Happy Meal toy, it probably is. Okay, we gotta go. Your moment of economic context, though. The oil giant Shell announced a major change to its tax and legal structure today. The company will drop Royal Dutch from its official name and move its headquarters to London. Worth noting, this spring, its home country, the Netherlands, ordered Shell to reduce its emissions by 45% by the end of the decade. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Molly Wood. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.